Yeah, and there's still people coming in. This is really good. Good morning. I'm Rich Becker, today's service leader, and I'd like to welcome you all to the North Shore Unitarian Church. I'd like to welcome any visitors that we have and invite you to join us for coffee and conversation immediately after the service in Fellowship Hall. We have a convention. If you take one of the yellow mugs, that will identify you as a visitor, and we'll make sure that we greet you appropriately. I'd also like to welcome Ron Miller to our pulpit this morning. As many of you know, Ron is chairman of the religion department at Lake Forest College and co-founder of Common Ground, which is an interfaith study center here in Deerfield. Ron has published a number of great books, and this past year he has come out with a translation and a commentary on the writings of the Apostle Paul. I think the translation alone would be worth the price, but I've always been impressed at the different perspectives that Ron brings to a commentary, beyond just history and linguistics and archaeology, but also, for instance, Jungian psychology, comparative religion, the tradition of divine healing, mysticism, and things like that. So if you're interested, Ron brought copies that you can purchase after the service. This morning's reading is a short but somewhat challenging passage from I and Thou by Martin Buber. Buber taught philosophy at Hebrew University in Jerusalem from 1938 to 1951. The world is twofold for man, in accordance with his twofold attitude. The attitude of man is twofold in accordance with the two basic words he can speak. The basic words are not single words, but word pairs. One basic word is the word pair I-you. The other basic word is the word pair I-it. But this basic word is not changed when he or she takes the place of it. Thus, the I of man is also twofold. For the I of the basic word I-you is different from that in the basic word I-it.
Oh, that wasn't that hard. Give me a couple hours, I can explain it for you. Well, it was many years ago on a summer day, much hotter than this one, when I was in a dorm at St. Louis University as a young graduate student in philosophy that I first read these words, and I remember being strongly impressed by them because perhaps it struck me for the first time that it wasn't so much the circumstances that determined our experience of the world, but the attitude we take toward the circumstances. In other words, as Buber says, I can address the world as an it, as an object, and see it as a problem to be solved. And I can meet everything around me as an object. Like King Midas in his greed for gold, experiencing all too late that even his young daughter hopping into his lap had turned to gold. Or we can take a different attitude toward the world, seeing it as a mystery in which we can participate. Feeling it, as Martin Buber would later write, from the other side, feeling it from the other side, as he talked about an experience he had as a child on his grandfather's farm, currying a pony, and he said one day he felt it not as though it was his hand brushing the pony, but as though it was the pony being brushed by his hand. And that became a paradigm for him of this idea of feeling the other side, entering into the mystery of the other, an intimate experience. The English translation doesn't quite grasp it. Kaufman's translation, I-you. In German, it's ich du. The older translation was I-thou, because in German, as in some other languages, you really have two different languages. One that expresses a circle of intimacy, in which you use the word du, We used to use this in English, the word thou. And then the other, a circle of greater distance, in which you would use the word Z. So there's a very different feel in German if I say, was haben Sie heute vor? What are you going to do today? And was hast du heute vor? What are you going to do today? In the one case, the du draws you into a relation of intimacy, and the Z keeps you at a certain distance. So the German title of the book is Ich Du. So we can have an attitude of intimacy toward the mystery of the other. Or we can have a problem-solving, objectivizing attitude of otherness. And according to the attitude we take, we live in a different world. So two people can be sitting next to each other and yet be living in a different world. All their experiences can be essentially the same and yet entirely different, because they're living in a different world. They're meeting the world with a different attitude. And this seems to describe to me the sort of the choice that faces us today in this mounting tension between Islam and the Western world. There are two prevalent models for the attitude that we are to take. One is expressed in Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations. This is based on the attitude toward Islam of a noted scholar, Bernard Lewis. Bernard Lewis is now in his 90s, and he represents a particular understanding of Islam. His work was especially popular in the 50s. He's not in favor among a younger generation of Mideastern scholars, but he was the great icon in an older time. And he is the one who is most favored in our present administration. Bernard Lewis is sort of the god for interpreting Islam, and from Bernard Lewis we get the interpretation of Huntington, The Clash of Civilizations. Now, coming from Martin Buber, we get another kind of possible attitude. And this is articulated in a book by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's the chief rabbi of London, or Great Britain, in a book called The Dignity of Difference. And there was a line in that book that so struck me that it led me to offer it as a workshop, a six-week workshop in Common Ground, and it indeed is the title of this presentation today. Rabbi Sacks said, "The antidote to violence is conversation. The antidote to violence is conversation." So we have two models, a clash of civilizations and a conversation of civilizations. And we're poised before those two models. The Muslim world and our Western world are poised before those options. For the most part, because of the fear in our world, an increasing number of Muslims and an increasing number of Westerners are choosing the clash of civilization model. Because it's more understandable in certain ways, it fits more the fear that so many people feel. And in some senses, it's easier to deal with because it reflects a tribal mentality of us and them, black and white, right and wrong, axis of evil, coalition of good, this kind of thing. Personally, I feel, as do I think most of the analysts, the younger generation, analysts of the Middle East and of this conflict in our world today, that model is not going to take us forward into a viable future, that model will indeed bring us into a third world war, and that we seriously need to reconsider the other model, the conversation of civilizations. That's where I see greater hope, and that's what I would like to address. The book that has most disclosed that to me, in addition to Rabbi Jonathan Sacks's book, The Dignity of Difference, is a book by Akbar Ahmed, A-H-M-E-D, who's a Pakistani who teaches at American University in Washington, D.C. He's written several books, Islam Under Siege, etc. But the book that I found most helpful in this regard is Journey into Islam. Journey into Islam. Dr. Ahmed goes with two of his graduate students, two American graduate students, and visits 11 Muslim countries and meets extensively with representatives of various attitudes toward the West, including people very hostile to the West, and groups that are philosophically very much geared to a clash model, the Wahhabi model in Saudi Arabia, the Deoband model in India. And for the first time, I think, I began to feel a certain empathy. You know, again, what Buber would call feeling the other side. I kind of understood why they feel the way they did, why many of them even see bin Laden as a kind of a hero, the David striking out at the Goliath of the American empire that they see encroaching on their world, their fear of globalization, countless interviews with people in which they say, what's going to come in the wake of this? Will the West remap the whole world? Will it dislodge all Muslim sources of power? Does this mean the McDonaldization of the world? Are we all going to just be Americans now? Will we all be spending hours with video games? Will we be pulled into this materialistic and pornographic society that has characterized the West? We don't want this. We resist this. Now, in various parts of the Muslim world, there is stereotypical thinking about the West and about Americans. And in these dialogues that Dr. Ahmed has in these various countries, he says people really do change their minds. Committed writers, I mean, writers who are writing books about this in Muslim countries who have never met American, never met an American, begin to see things differently. They begin to break down that black-white view of the world. When he talks to them about his collegial life in the United States with Jewish and Christian scholars and the kind of interactions that take place, when he begins to hear about Americans who are committed to social justice, who don't base their lives on materialism, who aren't saturated in a pornographic culture, that this doesn't describe all of us and who we are and what we do. And he says, if I could experience so much success with these two graduate students in this limited period of time, what would happen if since 9/11, we had been doing this on an extensive scale with countless centers of dialogue going on in which we're really trying to understand each other, and break down that stereotypical thinking. One of the things he discovers is that one of the things that are most offensive to Muslims are the way they're misunderstood in the West. When televangelists speak about Islam as a gutter religion, about Muhammad as a pedophile, when Bill O'Reilly compares the Quran to Mein Kampf, they hear these programs, and this is deeply offensive to them. Deeply offensive. Because, you see, they have such a history of marginalization. You know, since the end of World War I and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, virtually every Muslim society has been controlled by Western powers. They've been colonized and manipulated and misunderstood. And this has built up a pool of resentment. So when people ask today, why do they hate us? This is part of the reason. 70% of the refugees in the world are Muslim. Muslims are dying in many of these countries, and they're concerned that for the most part, the Western media really aren't paying attention to how many people are dying in Afghanistan and how many people are dying in Iraq. They feel this. they sense the hollowness of our rhetoric. Like one of my Iranian friends said, you know, when we talk about wanting to bring democracy to the Middle East, he said, we had a democracy in Iran. We had a president. And at that point, 95% of the oil revenues went to Great Britain and 5% to the Iranians. And so the president nationalized the oil. Well, United States and Great Britain immediately, started a coup and overthrew the democracy and put in the Shah so that our oil interests would be protected. I mean, they know we're lying when we say we care about how the Muslims live. And if there were no oil in Iraq, we wouldn't have had any interest in it. We wouldn't have cared if Saddam Hussein was killing people every day. They know our hypocrisy, and they know what our real interests are, and they know our fundamental ignorance about Islam. And many of them have the same fundamental ignorance about us and see us in the same kind of stereotypical fashion as we see them. And this is what I think has to change. There's a scary scene in here where he describes, this was just a year ago, in April 2006, he was part of an international conference on Islam in Washington, D.C. This was high power. The speakers included Dick Cheney, Henry Kissinger, Bernard Lewis, now in his 90s, Joe Biden Jr., and Francis Fukuyama. There were very few Muslims in attendance. And Akbar Ahmed was the only Muslim speaker. Now, the title of it was Islam in the West. Cheney gave the keynote address, and Kissinger said that if he wanted to know what to do, he would turn to Bernard Lewis first. This is a direct quote. I would go to Bernard first. And Kissinger, his talk was basically directed to the idea that we probably should be planning an attack on Iran. That Iran is the future danger. Well, Akbar Ahmed spoke next, and he said he was just stunned. He said he tried to explain that an attack on Iran would trigger a collective Muslim response. Not only would Shia throughout the world respond in passionate anger, but so would many other Muslims. The pro-West Arab regimes would come under intense pressure. Pakistan's large Shia population, some 30 million, would clamor to deploy its nuclear arsenal in support of a beleaguered and valued Muslim neighbor. You know, and Akbar Ahmed is thinking, does anyone here understand the Muslim world? Do any of these people have any idea of what is at stake? And he said in this book, he said, in the entire conference, he never heard the word dialogue or understanding or compassion. There was always this monolithic sense of Islam as this terrorist reality and an increasing tendency to compare it to Nazism. And I know myself, on at least two occasions when I've spoken about this, the analogy has been used, what you're saying is nice, but you're the Neville Chamberlain of this time. This notion that we would compromise somehow with this evil power is inappropriate. And Ahmed feels that we're driving the world toward an apocalypse. That our whole policy is based on the fact we have to have a credible enemy. See? And that is why there's so much of this tendency to compare Islam to Nazism today. He says, even mild suggestions of a dialogue with Muslims were dismissed at the conference as a means of appeasing evil, just as Lord Chamberlain, Britain's prime minister, had done with Hitler. Richard Perle, in a manual he wrote, How to Win the War on Terror, says, for us, terrorism remains the great evil of our time, and the war against this evil, our generation's great cause. There is no middle way for Americans. It's victory or Holocaust. Wolfowitz wrote, Muslims are people who worship death and not life, who worship the devil, I believe, and not God. They are the evil that has to be confronted. And Bernard Lewis himself had said, Muslims only respond to force. They need to be approached with firmness. You cannot dialogue with Muslims. I think this is a path of error. I sat at the college with three Turkish Muslims yesterday, part of the Niagara Foundation, part of the movement of Fethullah Gulen, a Sufi and a primary Muslim thinker, urging the path of dialogue and of peace, one who strongly condemns the actions of bin Laden, who wrote in an article he wrote on terrorism, if I were allowed to hate anyone in this world, I would hate Osama bin Laden because the way he has dragged my religion through the mud. Gulen is responsible for over 1,000 schools around the world, TV channel in Istanbul, a newspaper, promoting dialogue, promoting a combination of the Western sciences and a commitment to Quranic Islam, to the true understanding of Islam. There are so many forces that we could engage with in dialogue. And I think it's this conversation of civilizations that is needed. It's this conversation of civilizations that represents hope for me. Am I confident that it's going to work? No, because I think we've lost precious time. I think since 2001, our model has been the clash of civilization model. Our leading experts here and administrative heads have been formed by Bernard Lewis and have pursued this model of a clash. We have a war on terrorism. We don't try to understand it. We try to destroy it. We tend to lump the Muslim world together as terrorists. And in a sense, we promote Islamic fanaticism. Because our kind of tribal stance pushes the Muslim world into a tribal stance. And so the polarization has increased so that today it's worse than it's ever been in our nation's history. So it's not going to be easy to change the course from a clash model to a conversation model. I think it has to begin at every level. I think it has to begin with us. I mean, with those of you who believe in this or who believe it's possible, it's got to begin with understanding Islam, getting some correct information, reading the Quran, studying it, taking advantage of courses and workshops on the Quran, challenging the emails you get. I don't know about you, but I get them almost every day, Islamophobic emails, frightening in their misunderstanding of Islam. I think those need to be challenged. We need to promote dialogue. I think every church, synagogue, mosque, every civic organization, we need to do everything we can to get this conversation going, to make it normative, to read books like this, and to try to understand, to feel the other side. You know, what does it feel like to be an Iraqi? What does it feel like to be an Iranian today? What does it feel like to be almost anything other than an American? You know, why are we feared? Why are we hated in so many parts of the world? Even when I was last in Germany, where I've studied, I picked up a book and there was an ominous line in it that said, the United States has become a burden that the rest of the world may not be able to sustain much longer. See, we don't see ourselves in the eyes of others, I don't think. We don't have that attitude of Buber to feel the other side. By and large, our policies are being motivated by seeing the other as an object. This is a means to our having cheap oil. This is a means to our living as we have become accustomed to live. And Muslims are nothing more than a means to the end. They are to be manipulated according to our goals and our purposes. And ultimately, you know, what is good for America is good for the world, which has been the model of every empire from the beginning. So people ask me sometimes, am I optimistic? I'm not sure optimistic is the right word. It's possible that it's too late. It's possible that it's too late. And that a major war is inevitable. That's possible. But I have hope that it's not too late. I have hope that this course can be reversed. And when I read a book like this and see what one man with two graduate students does in visiting 11 countries, actually see Muslim leaders, writers, thinkers committed to a deeply anti-American stance, changing their mind. And when I see Americans reading books like this and changing their mind, then I have hope. So that to me is the only, you know, the only path to go. I can't guarantee that it's going to work. I don't think we ever have a guarantee. But I can certainly guarantee that the clash model will lead to extraordinary planetary devastation and a catastrophe it's going to take us a long time to grow out of. A long time to grow out of. So I think it makes sense for us to pursue this path of the conversation of civilizations. And I would encourage everyone to do what each can do, because we can. From letters to the editor, to what we do on the internet, to the kinds of programs we support, the kinds of workshops we attend, the kinds of candidates we elect. You know, I think this is something that each one of us can be active in, and I believe that it's not too late, because I think the path is a right one. I think the path of dialogue is the right path, and I think that ultimately that will be the one that will attract human response. And that's my hope and prayer. Amen.